Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Okay, today's little story is very simple. There was this man. He came to his Roshi, his teacher. And he said that he had fasted and he had prayed, you know, with his meditation and everything for 30 years. And he had still not come to understand God. You know, terrible trouble. He didn't know reality after working for it for 30 years. And so this Roshi told him, he says, you could sit for 100 years and it wouldn't be enough. So this man, you know, he looked at him and he says, why? Because your selfishness is working as a barrier between yourself and the truth, said the Roshi. No big deal. I mean, nothing to figure out about the story or anything else, huh? Okay. Now, the reality that people seek. The truth that you want to know is not hidden. The truth, this reality, is always right in front of you, right? The thing is, we call something by a name, and we're satisfied somehow that we know about it because we have named it, and we say we understand. Now, in Rhode Island, there lives a Korean Zen master. Now, I've never met him, but I've met a couple of his students, his disciples. And he is one that writes a great many letters, because some of the students can't come too often. And there's long spaces in between. So he does a great deal of his teaching through letters. And one letter went like this. Most venerable Zen master. And I'm leaving out some of the letter because it doesn't pertain to anything. But this student is supposed to be answering a koan. Yeah. Most venerable Zen master. Self-reliance has been my only teacher. And experience is my only guide. I have not practiced, but every day I sweep away the dust. I have no robe, but each day I meditate continuously on work, on troubles, and on play. I have no attainment, and I freely come and go. And I differentiate the one and the many, like one gunman facing another. The ancient masters taught me to reject anything that comes from words and practice, but especially to avoid attaching to their words and to avoid imitating them. I accept their words literally. Without explanation, without interpretation, they have given me the cutting tools of no thought, of no form, no abode, and no mind to help me keep away from attachments, keep away from separations, and in particular, to keep away from keeping away. That's important. I don't want frozen or muddied Zen. I don't want imitative systems, and I don't want gradual Zen. I don't want whip carts, and I don't imitate the Buddha. Without my living presence, I must humbly apologize to you. So this letter, which is filled with egotistical claims and implications, are all dead words and deadlier distinctions. If you are not in peace, it is because you are in pieces. Happy being. Happy being. Happy being. Yours in the neither doctrine nor no doctrine. And that's the end of the letter. Of course, there's no answer to any koan in there, of course. What do you think, a man wrote it or a woman wrote it? See him. Anyway, the teacher answers this letter. And what he says is, you understand too much. Understanding cannot help you. You say, I do this, and I do that, and I do the other thing. Is that necessary? If you have no I, then there's no problem. No hindrance means complete freedom. In other words, complete freedom, great love, great compassion, and the great bodhisattva way. Zen means not making anything. Then moment to moment, you can keep your correct situation, your correct function, and your correct relationship. And that's Zen. I hope you only go straight. Just don't know. Soon finish the great work of life and death. Get enlightenment and save all people from suffering. That's that letter. Just don't know. Just don't know. When you think you know, you close a door. Just don't know. Anyway, the emphasis in this letter business here, written conversation, is understanding. Understanding. What do you understand? What is under where you stand? Something standing under, isn't it? It's supposed to be the ground of being, which is what Meister Eckhart called it. What do you think you understand of that? We have had in this world, on this planet, men who really understood, truly understood, And because of their understanding, traditions were born and endured. And then we had some people that had understanding. And some sex came out of it. S-E-C-T-S, sex. Then we had more men of little understanding and more sex were born. And then we have had men who call themselves understanding, and we have had a great deal of trouble. On this planet, we have had a Buddha. We have had an Atan Ra. We have had a Mohammed. We have had a Zarathustra. We have had a Socrates. We had a Jesus. And they unveiled for us, for everybody. They tried to show. They uncovered what is hidden from us. And of course, they had to use words to talk about it. So we, you know what we do? We look out there for words, and we go a little further and look for more words, and we're looking for more words on top of that. We're always looking for words. And as we accumulate these words, we say, oh, our understanding grows. But what those great ones attained, what they saw, what they perceived, what they experienced, what they uncovered, do you know that? That's important. No word, no concept. And it's, we have to dig it out by ourselves, you know, this reality of ourselves. And then along comes somebody like Albert Einstein or Heisenberg or Niels Bohr, and they uncover things. They discover things, and what they discover becomes common property. They teach about it in schools to school children. It doesn't need to be discovered again. They discover it, and now we know it. See, so there is understanding, and there is understanding. So be careful how you use the word understanding. In the religious field, a Buddha discovers, uncovers. A Mohammed uncovers, you know. And you have to uncover it again. You have to do it for yourself. You know? And we look at this and we think, well, what's the matter here? You know, somebody uncovered it. It should be for everybody now. Yeah. And we do lament it is all hidden from us. Except here a glimpse and there a glimpse. Everywhere a glimpse, glimpse, you know. Why, then, we say, why does nature hide the light? Because the light, all things are light. You know, I quoted it last Sunday. It is he that has gone abroad, that which is bright, bodiless, pure, without scar of imperfection. He, the seer, the thinker who becomes everywhere. That I see in thee, and not otherwise than this. So we say nature hides the light from us. Nature hides the truth from us. Maybe not. Maybe nature is not hiding the light. Maybe the veil is not on the truth. It may be that the veil is yours. Everyone has to unveil himself. Truth has to be uncovered again and again and again by each and by everyone. It can never become common property. It remains individual, yours, Whatever you have of it is yours. And we don't see, you know, it's like we've got closed eyes. And we seem to avoid somehow actually looking at the truth in everything and in ourselves. So I would like to ask, do you have a great investment in closed eyes? Do you have a great investment in them? Well, if you don't, why don't you open your eye? Open that eye. Open that single eye so that your whole house is full of light. Who's keeping it from you? Who is preventing you from knowing the truth? You know, we have a saying about naked truth. It's the naked truth. Truth is nude. It's naked. And that's the nature of truth. No clothing. It is the truth. And it's just right in front of you. And it has always been. And it will always be. You know, there was a woman at one time that they brought her into a psychologist. And she was a very beautiful young woman. Her husband had died. See, they'd been married 3 months. You know, and they were very much in love. They had disobeyed their families to get married. They were from different strata of society, different religions. But, oh, they were so very much in love. And 3 months, and the whole thing was all over. And it's hard to take, you know. And it was too much for this woman. And she closed her eyes on hearing of his demise, and she wouldn't open them again. You know? If she opened her eyes, she would have to admit, yes, he's dead. She kept her eyes closed, and who says my husband is dead? My husband isn't dead. Who says my husband is dead? No. Closed eyes, huh? And people did try to persuade her. Open your eyes and look at what is. No. And those eyes remained shut. My husband is not dead. And this went on for 3 days. And it had come time that the body had to be taken care of, whether they buried it or cremated it or whatever, you know, but the time had come. So they did, and then that much was all over with. So then she opened her eyes. But she had lost the capacity to see. The eyes were all right, no problem. But it was as if somebody that is behind the eye had stepped back, and so that the window was there, but there was nobody looking out of it. She couldn't see. And weeks went by, and a couple of months went by, and she remained just psychically blind. And all this time she's saying, who says my husband is dead? My husband isn't dead. Who says my husband is dead? So anyway, they finally brought her to a psychologist, and the man starts talking to her, and he says, you know, your husband is very troubled. This morning he came to see me, and he's suffering very much because you can't see. You're having a problem with your eyes. Why don't you see? It's bothering him. See? And he talked on and on and on as if her husband were still alive, and, you know, that he expected him to walk in the door any minute and talk to her also. So finally she broke down, and she looked at him and she says, my husband is dead. Why do you say he was here this morning? He's dead. And just like that she could see. Yeah. She realized that she had been denying something in her, and therefore that caused the blindness. And through her denial, this false blindness came about. Once she accepted the fact that her husband was dead, and in that moment she screamed, almost like a primordial scream. She screamed, see, and it was half an hour before they could right her again where she was normal. But at that time the storm was all gone, and she was fine, and she thanked the counselor. He'd done his job well. Now, you know, between you and me, you know how often I say, do not deceive yourself. We know many things we pretend we don't know. We pretend we know many things we don't know. You're looking for the truth. Itself. Never mind talking about it, but the truth itself. Are you truthful with yourself? If you're not, how can you win? Victory is with the truth. You can create illusions, and we do. We've created a lot of them. We can live in a blindfolded world. We can live in dreams. We can live with sightless eyes. Make any difference? Your fictitious world is fictitious. You must accept that. And truth is just sitting there in front of you, sitting there inside of you, waiting, just waiting, and you're covering it. The more and the longer that you live with your fictions, the more you will be fearful of their being shattered. And of course, this is one of the reasons we're afraid of facing ourselves. It's the fictions that we have to look at. Certainly you're not afraid of the self. No, nobody's afraid of the self. It's the fictions with which you cover yourself. Yeah? The self is what you want. The barrier against it is the fiction. The problem is, we no longer know it as fiction. Some of it is so long buried, and then it's in here, you know, and we say, we're afraid of the unknown. That's why we can't do anything more than we're doing. We're afraid of the unknown. We don't know how the self appears. We don't know what the self looks like, so we're fearful of it. No, you're not. No, you're not. No. We're fearful of the journey. Are you? Why? Because we're afraid of the fictions. We might bump into one any old time. Please. If you really want to know, set aside what you think you know. Set aside, you know, whatever experiences you've had. Set aside what you think about them and about yourself. And just don't know. Yeah. If you just don't know, you can deal with these fictions easily. Instead of letting them rule you. Remember, we're the last ones to see our own fictions. Those around you read you well. Like Jack used to say, I'm always the last to know. Well, yeah. And of course, you know, we have this fiction up here also, and we rely on it heavily on this facade. I am somebody. There is a book out somewhere along the line. I haven't read it, but it's I Am a Nobody Going Nowhere. We don't like that.
Yeah.
I'm somebody. Every person, in some way or another, at some time or another, believes that he or she is somebody. And he or she believes somewhere in there that I not only that I'm somebody, but I'm somebody very special. It can be pretty well hidden. It may be predominant. What difference does it make? It may be, you may have a great deal of belief in the statement, I am somebody special. Or you may have just a little tiny touch of belief. It may be you're not so aware that you do believe it. You know, you got to look and see, do I believe I'm somebody special, maybe? Do you believe you're somebody special? Oh, yes, I do. Oh, yes, I do. If you didn't, you wouldn't act like you do. It gives you away every time, huh? Then comes one of the desert fathers centuries ago, living out in the desert, the Hesychast, you know, and he starts out by saying, in our incomprehensible self-deception, we do not cease to believe that we are something and someone not unimportant. Realize your nothingness. You know, it's just don't know. Just don't know. Because if you don't know, then there is this opportunity, there is this chance for the one who is everywhere and everything. You have a chance to be that. And that's what you want. But as long as you're something, you're in the way. Now, it is true. You are unique in this phenomenal world. Everybody is unique in this phenomenal world. We all have a little special something whereby we're different than everybody else. But when you come right down to it, basically, all somebodies are nobodies. There's only one. There is one man. One being. You know him. Christianity calls him Christ. That's the West, huh? In the East, they call him the Zen man. Call him Buddha. Yeah. So the question, who are you, is of great import. That somebodyness that you really want to be, you think, this is me. That's an ego, and it's a fiction. It's a concept, huh? And you hope, people, oh, it's incredible, people hope against hope. They've got, they're all sunk into it, that that fiction is going to survive. Hmm? That fiction is going to attain. That fiction is going to be enlightened. And we go on pretending, trying to support this pseudo-self, this fiction, trying to prove that we're somebody. Look at all I understand. I'm somebody. See, you go on, you not anybody here, of course not, but people go on trying to prove that they're the center of the world. I mean, this is, you know, we can see it through history that this is what people have done. But we know quite well that this is not true, huh? Yeah. We're not the center of the world, because we know that the world was here when we were not. And we know that the world will be here when we are not. So we can't very well be the center of the world. But now I'm here, and I'm somebody special, and I help to make this world go round. You are the center of your world. I say you. There is a center in your world that we must come to know. You're not the center of the world until you do know, and then you are. When we say I, you know, I this and I that and I that, you know, unless you do know what is the real I, when you say I, you should know it as a linguistic device. You know, and there are moments when you feel, you know, you're really part of the whole. Yeah. And then you go right on with this, pretending I'm somebody. How can you be part of the whole and be somebody? You know, our lives, you know, it's like it becomes a long procession of things that are not. And the things of the procession, the pretenses, there are veils. God is not hidden. Truth is just in front of you. Truth is in front of you in its total nakedness. You're hidden. You are the one that is swathed in veils. Just drop the pretense and don't know. This is so difficult. Oh my. It's so difficult. You know, I have known some, a few here and there, fairly well along on the path. And they still play their little games of deception. It's almost as if we have built an investment in blindness. And it's very painful to drop the pretense. Dropping the pretense means suffering. And we don't like pain. Somewhere, someday, you've got to get through. You must pass through those veils. It's part of your growth. If you avoid, you are avoiding your own maturity, and you may never then see reality face to face. the totality, the truth. Will not accept pretense. We live in our illusions. And we do and we can create beautiful illusions. We have very good imaginations. We dream beautiful dreams. We plan beautiful plans. We dream we're an emperor, or we're a queen, or we're the center of the concert, or we're the star on the stage. Whatever, you know? We're it. Oh, we're somebody so special, you know? We're never a knave, never a thief, never anything like that, no. Morning comes, and you have to open your eyes, and the dream disappears, and you will come to know how you have deceived yourself. So, isn't it better maybe to suffer a little bit and get out of it? No. This kind of suffering, I think, is easier than some of the traditions, you know, they have such strange things, austerity, they call it. In Tibet, at a particular point in time, you're sent out to the cemetery, and there you sit in the cemetery with the wolves howling all around and the dogs barking, and you're cold, and this fear rises, and you've got to sit there for 3 days and three nights. I just as soon look at my pretenses, please. See? And in the ancient mysteries, you know, you lie in a coffin for 3 days. Which the Society of Jesuits, they practiced for a while. I don't know if they still do or not, but anyway. And it is all taken from the ancient Egyptian mysteries. You know. The American Indian, he's when a boy reaches the age of puberty, they send him out into the wilderness, all alone. He's got to take care of himself out there. He may return only after he has had a vision. And whatever the vision represents, that becomes his new name, his grown-up name. Through the gates of disillusionment, austerity. We don't need to go stand in the hot sun, you know, staring at the sun until we no longer have any eyes. And we don't need to lie down on a bed of nails or a bed of thorns. We don't have to spend the rest of our life with our arm held up or our foot held up as they do. What does that prove? We only need to go through these gates in ourselves. We do not need to torture the body. These are foolish things. Or rather, maybe we could say these are stupid things thought up by foolish minds. The austerity is to see things as they are now. To see your illusions as illusions. The austerity is to become disillusioned. To drop the hopes and don't know. And we know that we have to return within ourselves to a simple purity and a non-duality, and so be that innocent child. It is impossible, said one of the desert fathers also, for us to become reconciled and united with God if we do not first return to ourselves. So watch for the pretenses and then drop. Just drop them. Whatever the price of it is, pay it. It has to be paid. If you haven't loved and just pretended that you love, you say something to yourself. Admit it. Admit maybe that it was a very subtle process of exploitation, that maybe it was a trick. Maybe it was a trick to dominate, or maybe it was just a facade for your sexual desires. Maybe it was nothing but ambition. Or maybe it was some form or other of security. Let yourself know what is going on. Allow it, and whereabouts you're at, then the doors open. Now, in this story, this man came to this Roshi and said he had fasted and prayed and so on for 30 years, and yet he didn't understand. He didn't understand God, you know. Well, we can look at that and say, yes, well, he had the wrong attitude from the beginning. How do you count moments of love? How do you count moments of prayer? How do you count moments of meditation? How can you say that for 30 years I've been sitting there in meditation and, you know, what do I know? I don't understand. You know, that's a business mind. That's a calculating mind. See, and with that kind of a mind, nothing happens. If you know what meditation is, if you know what prayer is, then time doesn't matter. See, prayer is its own result. Meditation is its own result. You pray, you meditate. That's enough. Why do you put time into it? You're trying to get out of time. You keep stuffing it back in. I mean, if this is the case, then you're not meditating. You're just sitting around there waiting for a result. What kind of a deal have you got with yourself? I'll do this if God does that. It's kind of a bargain, huh? Then the whole thing is just nothing but a means to an end. Meditation is an end in itself. To sit, just to sit, is so tremendous. Are you going to count the hours that you sat? My God, if I look back the 20 years that I'm going to count hours? Oh, no. I'm just going to thank you that I could. Thank you that I was shown a way. You know, all that's beautiful, love and prayer, meditation, enjoy. Just enjoy. Don't all enjoy. It's like walking. You get up early in the morning and you go walking through the woods. You used to do that up there in Zurich. It's fantastic, huh? Little walking paths all over. You know, the sun is rising and a new day is being born. Life is resurrected out of the dark of night. You know, everything's revived. Now we can see the trees are green. We can see the birds and we can hear them. They're beginning, you know. And if there's doves around, they go, turtle dove, turtle dove. There's flowers beginning to open. See, and there's a nice fresh breeze. And you walk and you enjoy. You're exhilarated just to be there. You keep a diary saying, well, now I've been walking for 30 years in the morning and nothing has happened to me. A morning walk is a morning walk. Evening sit is an evening sit. You enjoyed. Every morning walk enriches you. You may not know it, but it does. It doesn't enrich you somewhere in the future, but it is accumulative, what this enjoyment does, and it's the same with sitting. When your eyes are open, you can see. And life gives. And you take it in love and in gratitude and in awe. And you have a great humbleness for that which has been shown to you. If you can attain to one single moment of real meditation, you will not complain ever about time spent sitting. Ever. Okay. I'm sorry I'll keep you so long. Except we had a lot of hoorah to begin with. I really don't talk as long as you think. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.